Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Christopher Hastings. Chris is a comic book artist, writer, and a cast member of Rude Tales of Magic, where he played Frederick de Bonesby and Odysseus of Stars of Space, playing, among others, Dreadcount 900, Dr. Thomas Dewey, and Begonia Blood Terror. Now he is taking over as the GM for the latest campaign of Rude Tales of Magic. Chris, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Hello, thank you. Gosh, I think you gave me more of a red carpet for that job than my own castmates did. It's like, I'm like, oh my God, you make it sound like a really big deal.
It is a big deal.
It is a big deal. Oh no, it's a big, beautiful deal.
I'm gonna call Tim and make sure he gets you a big bundle of flowers or something.
That is the correct person. He would do it. on Rude Tales, we do we do little bonus episodes of talking about whatever for our Patreon and such. And I think it was Carly and I did one talking about like being a nice host to people in your home. One thing that was about it was like what should people bring? And we were like, it's always nice when someone brings paper towels. Like, just, and now Tim does it every time he comes to our house. He brings a roll of paper towels, and he puts them next to the massive bulk stash of paper towels we have in our house. I'm like, you don't have to do this. He's like, no, it's nice to do. So yeah, Tim would give me flowers.
You got to put the flowers in the paper towel roll. That's a fancy day.
Oh,
no, there we go. That's pretty good. As we get into this, I want to kind of set the table a little bit, because we always like to come into these conversations with kind of a goal. And our main goal for this conversation is to look at Rude Tales, which is you guys started in 2019, a very long running show in the actual play space.
I guess it is now. How about that?
I know, right?
5 years. Goodness gracious.
To take a look at a show that has been running for that long, just finishing a long-running campaign, to look at that transition of moving from one campaign to the next and also from one GM to the next. And I also just want to get into the weeds of talking about actual play production and, you know, an emerging art form and the future and, you know, all the good stuff that everyone loves this show for.
Yeah, let's be nerds. Big old nerds.
But to start us off, just to kind of set the table for anyone who might not be aware of Rude Tales or hasn't started listening to the new season, can you give us the quick pitch for Rude Tales Nethermerk?
Oh, yeah. So for Nethermerk specifically. So like Rude Tales of Magic is what it says on the label. There is a fantasy element and then there is a potty humor element, the rude and the magic. And yeah, it's a bunch of us. You know, everybody on the show came to know each other through our time doing improv comedy, with the exception of my wife and I, who met via being married. And a lot of us played Dungeons & Dragons at some point, just for funsies. And we all decided to start doing it on microphone together and for a very long time. Branson Reese was our dungeon master, game master, whatever. I like saying dungeon master over game master. It's a lot more fun. I know like Hasbro probably owns it now, but like I think it's just a more fun word.
It is. I'm so used to it because we play so many other games where it's like very explicitly game master or some other word. But every time I hear dungeon master, it does kind of scratch a certain itch.
Right?
Like,
yeah.
That one is fun.
Especially if you're, you know, touching the potty humor world, it adds a fun zest.
Yeah.
So Branson ran things for a good long time in our main campaign, which we call Class Dismissed. And then we kind of started talking about how to transition. And we did a few months of a campaign called Piss Harbor, which is sort of like a grimy 70s or 80s, like crime and bounty hunters kind of a deal where a character that sounds like Cher gives, a bunch of fantasy bounty hunters a mission to kill somebody every episode. And that person was a guest star. It was a way for us to kind of do something that was a little bit less of like, all right, now for our next big epic adventure and like take a bit of a breather. And also a way to very easily have a lot of guest stars and kind of just palate cleanse, really. And we took that time to figure out what we wanted to do next, and we opened up the idea of other people taking over to run the show. And I have dungeon mastered many times in my life, and I had some ideas about what I wanted to do to kind of keep the tone of the show while also kind of putting my own spin on things. And so that is Nethermerk. And Nethermerk is kind of our goofy and scary take on the Forgotten Realms' Underdark. I grew up reading R.I. Salvatore. You know, I thought a good drow was like the coolest thing ever, you know, like every other nerdy teenager in the 90s. And so I was really excited. I knew when it comes to parody, I think that making fun of something you love is a lot easier and more fun than making fun of something you hate. And so I was just like, okay, I know this like fantasy cave shit like in my bones. So that's where I want us to go. And so that is what Nethermerk is the idea that it's much in the way that like the Forgotten Realms is Underdark is very much driven by, you know, the Spider Queen Lolth, the evil Spider Queen who kind of like all the evil in the cave kind of trickles down from her through a, you know, this society that's like really status obsessed and evil and all that. And then, you know, all the weird, creepy monsters that somehow have to be so nasty to survive without light. And so similarly, we have this sort of like idea that like there is a god who made a lot of monsters on the planet's surface, and humanity was so disgusted they cast all the monsters down into the caves along with God. And so there is this big mystery about where is God? He's dug somewhere down in the caves. And then there's all these terrible monsters and these various societies. And the main thrust of the campaign is about this group of adventurers who are, this is where it gets overcomplicated. there's a group of, not the God in the caves thing. No, it's that like, much like in the Underdark, you know, spiders are a big deal, giant spiders. And so we have a society that like treats them as cattle, essentially. And then everything changes one day when a spider who is intelligent shows up and says, spiders are revered on the surface. They're treated like family pets, and what you're doing is awful. And so all these adventurers decide to drive the spiders to the surface, which they have never seen before in their lives. I could keep rambling about Nethermerk. I could just start summarizing the entire season.
Yeah, just pull up your notes and read it bit by bit. No, I guess for folks who don't know, is this going to be a chapter that is as long as the Rude Tales that they've come to know and love? Do you foresee this going for several years from now, or is this more of a one-off then?
Thank you. That is something that we are figuring out as we go. We were going to just do like 6 episodes of it. And then as the story went, I very quickly realized that we were getting nowhere near the plot beats I had planned out. I think
I'm very familiar with this problem.
Yeah, of course. we all know how that goes. You know, they get to like where I thought episode 1 was going to end. They got to by the end of episode 3. So I was like, I kind of was like, hey, do you think maybe we can just like double the length of this? And like, everybody's like, yeah, everybody's really into it. Everybody has great characters and they have really fun chemistry. So like, yeah, they're into still going. And then as we kept going, I think we're all just like, this could go on forever. And we recently stumbled into a happy little accident that allows us to expand it even more if we want, which is that, so we typically, because everybody lives in different places now, we don't all have access to the old Brooklyn studio that we used to. We do a recording style called camp, where we all take off like work for a week and we just get together in the studio every single day and we bang out, you know, months worth of episodes in a week. And so we did those first 6 episodes during a camp. And then recently we heard from comedian James Adomian, who is an incredible vocal talent, very funny guy. And he's promoting his new comedy special and wanted to know if he could come on the show, with the caveat being we would need to put him in an episode that came out before his comedy special. We couldn't put him on, you know, episode 7 or something that's going to come out in, I don't know, November. And so we're like, okay. And I told Joe, our producer / the guy who plays the kobold adventurer, Paris Kansas.
I love that.
Yeah, that's so funny. I was like, let me sleep on it. Let me see if I can figure something out here to make this guest thing work. And then I kind of was like, oh, you know, there's whenever all of the adventurers leave town with all the spiders, there is like a raid on the city that happens. The idea being is like I'm trying to create these dilemma points for them. There was this moment where they could choose to go ahead and run off with the spiders, or they could stick around in town and like refuse to go on with that mission. If they stayed in town, they would be in this battle that was about to happen. And instead, they decided to abandon their families.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, and it's like I really like having these decisions that really matter. Like some like it's going to be dramatic whichever way they choose. There's no wrong answers. But I really wanted to show what happened in the town, and we keep having these moments in episodes like 4 onward where I was like, "Oh, this would be a good time to cut away and see what's going on," but like just the way of the improvised narrative, it never really fit. And I was like, okay, this episode, we're going to just do it. We're going to stick and see what the point of view is of the people in the town who are fighting and what happens there. And so I had the party all make new characters. They are now the evil elves who are raiding the peaceful city of bats, the bat people. And we have James be our special guest. He plays a member in a band that one of the other characters mentions in a earlier episodes. So it's like, oh, he's already set up to exist in this world. Just like drop him in and it fits perfectly. And then when we did that, I was like, I don't want this just to be a one-off thing that we do just because we had a guest show up and like suddenly we have new characters. So I'm kind of saying like, I think like every few episodes, let's check in with these elf characters you've made. And then it's kind of like combining, you know, this actual play, narrative play thing and sort of like the tradition of like epic fantasy novels that have multiple viewpoint characters. So now we're introducing the idea of multiple viewpoint parties. And I'm really excited to see where that goes because, yeah, there's stuff I want to show off in the world that I've built in this cave system while the party is going up away from it. So this is a way to get everything I want. And obviously this means I probably just tacked on an extra year to the campaign just by deciding that was a fun idea.
I do think it's interesting because, like, as you said, that is like a trope of a lot of fantasy things, multiple viewpoints, meanwhile, back at the ranch. But I'm curious if that, I'd be surprised if that didn't at least partially come from, oh, these are Stars of Space, where you guys are playing different, like the same location, but different characters all of the time. So I think like it's fun that the impulse to, I enjoyed the impulse to be just like, you want to do something different? Great. We'll just keep in the same world. We'll do a whole different thing. And then we'll just keep doing that. We'll just keep expanding these like multiple different things.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Like I didn't even think about it because I'm so used to us playing different characters all the time on our other program. Those Stars of Space, our Star Trek parody. yeah, I was like, I knew they could do it. It wasn't a question. I knew they would be excited to do it. It's just like, yeah, you want to roll up a new character? Everybody loves rolling up characters. Yeah, and like it was easy. They're all very good at it. And I really like the idea that I now have them playing enemies to each other. Like, right. I will say, I am a dungeon master who does not mind splitting the party. I like it. I can handle it fine. I think it makes for an interesting, more interesting show. There's this thing in improv where you can have like 2-person scenes, 3-person scenes, where you have a couple of the actors, you know, going on stage and making their shit up while everybody else waits in the wings. And then you will break these scenes up with what is called a group game, where everybody comes in and it's like a very big chaotic thing. And there's a couple ways to do what are called group games or these big group scenes. An entire show of group games is exhausting. And when you have the entire cast there in the same room together all the time, you're getting nothing but that. So I really like splitting them off occasionally and getting to do little smaller scenes and giving each of them a little bit more screen time, headphone time. It's audio.
Spotlight time.
Spotlight. A little bit more spotlight. Yeah.
There we go.
So I really like splitting them off from each other, and I'm excited to have these different combos where we might have, you know, Carly's evil elf character in a room with Tim's, you know, human character, you know, and vice versa, like switching those things around. And even when we're doing these, though, sometimes Joe makes us do our characters like with each other. It is hard. It is hard when you're jumping around through 3 of them. But I'm excited about the possibilities, and it really comes from just a total trust in the cast.
And I think that, like, it's I love that you pointed out this, that this is a thing of epic fantasy, you know, this multiple viewpoints thing. And also, I feel like the split the party thing is only a thing we say no to in, like, running a D&D campaign or running a TTRPG campaign. Like, every other kind of story, it's like, yeah, split up your heroes. It makes life harder and it's more interesting.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just funny that it's such an impulse in this kind of play where people are like, why would you ever do that? It's like, because it's a good story.
I mean, it can increase mental load on your GM.
Oh, for sure.
To have to, like, suddenly being processed, like running back, you know, back processing of what's happening in another space while you're doing another scene. Heck, even so, something we haven't talked about yet with Nethermirk is that Branson, previous GM, he is not a party member. He is strictly doing NPCs. And this is useful to me because I have a hard time figuring out everything that's like keeping a wheel on the world while I'm doing some wacky voice shopkeeper or whatever. So it's very helpful for me to have somebody else just talk to the players for a minute while I figure out the next thing that's going to happen. Very useful.
Also to have somebody to talk to if you need multiple NPCs, so you're not doing the, and then he says, and then she says.
It's so freeing. Like, I think it's like our second or third episode. I think we just open with two NPCs talking to each other, and it's not just me doing both voices. It's really, really exciting. It opens up so many possibilities.
What brought you guys to that decision to set up the game that way?
This was part of my pitch to the group for being the person who took over the main campaign, is that I believe that Branson's voice, both figuratively and literally, is very important to the identity of Rude Tales of Magic. You know, for a very long time, he literally did make the world, and he did the voices of all of the characters who weren't players in those worlds. And I think continuing that in a way, spitting that off, is really important to, even though the show is changing, there is still something that's still very familiar. I think that's a really important thing whenever, as a show or anything evolves, is that you do need to keep the balance of the familiar and the novel. So, like, for example, you know, we are in, you know, this cave system and all the weird monsters and stuff. That's all very new. But, like, elements from are sprinkled in from our previous campaign. The idea that dark elves have Italian accents, that there is a connection with dark elves and giant spiders. Like, Branson introduced that in like a wacky NPC in a very early episode of Rude Tales of Magic. I was like, okay, let's pick that up again. There's other like little touches where I kind of remind people that it's like, it's still the same show. And I think that keeps a little bit of cohesion.
It's something that like we have talked a lot about with our show recently, and we've made the move towards a lot of our seasons now. We have one of us sit in a producer chair and kind of be an assistant GM to the GM, where it's like we're in the planning sessions and like we're in the sessions as producers being like, oh, hey, here's a fun idea that you might use, or like here's a time check or whatever. And I think that like when you share the load, you're just making a more sustainable product, and you're able to do fun things like maintain multiple narratives and stuff like that. So I really like the like impulse to like, oh, let's keep this person who's already been thinking like a GM for a while, for also for you jumping into the GM chair for the first time for the show, having that support as well. Like, whereas like, I'm not that I don't believe you could do it on your own, but like it, I'm sure it helps to have somebody kind of in your corner that you can talk to about all the things.
Your belief doesn't factor into it. I don't want to do that. You're absolutely correct. The help is massive. I do like most of the prep work by myself, like just writing out like what I want to do. But I will check in with Branson before every show, and I'll be like, here's where I think I want this episode to go, just so you know what to hit. And like, so he's, and then he'll bounce ideas back off of me. It's really useful. And yeah, it's exactly what you said. I have nothing to add to that. It's like, it's just nice to have a little help.
It is great for our latest season. Elliot was the producer and I was the GM. And it was great to be like running a thing and then all of a sudden look up in the chat. Like, we have a Discord chat open that will like, he'll give me time checks and all that stuff. And every now and then just we'll have like a killer line.
Oh, cool.
And I'm like, I'm doing a monologue and I'm like, you know, running the world. And all of a sudden the you know, mic drop line is right there. I'm like, hell yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. That's great.
It's great that I just get to look really cool.
I have to, Joe Lepore has tried to do that for me on Oh, These the Stars of Space. And I read a message and I just go blank. I'm like, and I so anytime Joe gives the killer line, you know that there is some dead air that gets cut before it comes out. Having to read something short circuits me completely out of improvised stuff.
I get it. And then kind of turning to like actual play as a whole, because we're relatively, we've been doing this for 2 or 3 years, and that's starting to be considered like we've been around for a while.
This is such news to me. I guess I just don't follow enough of what's going on out there. It's hard to listen to other shows when you're always listening to your own. I didn't realize that like that was such a thing, that shows coming, like there's a high turnover rate.
I think that there is a high turnover just because it's tough to sustain. I mean, like no matter what you're doing, this is hard work week after week or you know, by week after by week. But I think like, you know, when people think of the biggest, you know, Dungeons & Dragons or actual play shows right now, they probably think of Critical Role, which is a couple of years older.
Never heard of it.
Dimension 20, which...
Yeah, don't know right. That one either.
Dimension 20 and None of the D&D podcast came out 2018, so like a year before you guys. And then Dungeons and Daddies came out, I think, a year or two after.
Oh,
so like
they didn't precede us? I thought they did. I don't know.
I might be wrong there. But you guys are kind of in that air of that like big generation when actual play went from just like Penny Arcade to just Penny Arcade and Critical Role, and then to explode.
Yeah, it is. Considering how popular this is, it is crazy to look back and just be like, oh, like Acquisitions Incorporated was the only game in town for quite a while, and was very popular. Nobody else thought, like, why don't we put a camera on us when we play Dungeons and Dragons?
Yeah, there was a long line of like one show was popular, and then all of a sudden, poof. And I guess I'm curious from your perspective, what do you see as being different in the actual play space from when you started versus now?
I think, let's see here. I mean, I'll start by maybe just speaking to our own show instead of making up theories about others. I think a big thing that Root Tales does is we're evolving our relationship with the game itself. So like, you know, it's you can have a show that's, you know, 5 hours long that has every dice roll and every little piece of math checking to make sure how bonuses interact with terrain disadvantage, et cetera, which is a very fun. I want to be very clear. I love to play that game and I miss that game. I personally don't believe that makes for terribly great radio. That is my opinion. And I do know that like there are a lot of people who really like to follow along with the game, because it's like if they know the rules of the game, they inherently understand the drama of everything that's happening with playing it correctly. Correctly, big air quotes, correctly. And I think that is very interesting for a lot of people. It's not what we're interested in doing. And so we do kind of have to interrogate where the cross-section is between a game and like an improvised show. And I personally have kind of really been thinking a lot about what the dice rolls do for a show. I don't necessarily believe you need to edit them out entirely. I do think that there is drama inherent in the chaos of the dice roll. And I think that the dice allow for the same thing that made our stage improv shows fun, which is that element of chance. It's that suggestion. You know, it's like in an improv show, to prove we haven't written it, we take an audience suggestion and then we run with that. Some word or whatever that inspires us to just go nuts. And in this case, someone can say like, I'm going to jump off the tower and drive my knife into the eye of the dragon. And I say, well, you're going to try. let's roll. And I think that's really exciting to not just let a character, not just let an actor dictate the story, but to invite in that element of chance and to invite in that suggestion that keeps improvisers on their toes. So the way that I run Nethermerk is we do have pretty bare bones character sheets that Branson made they're just like, it's basically like just the main stats, like, you know, your strength, your constitution, et cetera. And they have abilities that I let them kind of take advantage on, like they can roll with advantage with on certain stuff with their characters. And a lot of that is just like, a trust that they know which specific actions they take are going to be slotted to which of their main scores. And instead of assigning, you know, bonuses and negatives to like whatever they've trained or not, I basically know what is reasonable for their characters to be good at and bad at. And I will give them higher or lower difficulties on the fly that they just have to hit. And that makes that go much more quickly and kind of keeps things moving while also allowing for the, you know, like I said, the drama, the chaos of the dice.
If you want to try Dungeons & Dragons but don't know where to start, you should know about startplaying.com. D&D rulebooks can be overwhelming, and playing with experienced players as a newbie can be intimidating. But at startplaying.com, they make it so easy to find a beginner-friendly D&D game. Plus, they've got this great new feature to help you find that perfect game. It's their Learn to Play D&D quiz. Just answer a few short questions and they'll match you with a professional dungeon master and a bunch of other new players so everyone at the table can learn the game together. And you don't need to worry about creating a character or buying dice or anything else that might be getting in your way. All you need to do is start playing. And if you want to try other tabletop games like Good Society or Orbital Blues or The Wild Sea, you can find those too. So if you want to slay some dragons and make some friends, head on over to startplaying.com.
Your next favorite game is on My First Dungeon.
Hello and welcome to My First Dungeon. Hello and welcome to My First Dungeon. Ho, 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 and welcome to My First Dungeon.
From Sad Space Cowboys.
Kamari takes out a lighter from their pocket and goes, this bar's next.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Let's go.
To death metal Viking cats.
Hello Kitty, you see Melody Tuffington flying through the air, jacked as shit, massive legs, to horny snowmen?
The sad part is that Joshua never gave Frosty a penis.
No.
And everything in between.
It was a dark and stormy night.
We've got something for everyone.
You're a special Gertrude girl in a special Gertrude world. Happy birthday, happy birthday. I'm not a skeleton.
Learn the game, then hear it in action.
That's Snake Eyes minus two. That's a zero.
Snake Eyes, that means that we have our very first plot twist. Anytime somebody rolls doubles, we get a plot twist.
So grab some headphones.
And get lost in a story with us.
I'll be honest, I don't know all the rules of it. We'll kind of figure that out as we go. But do you want to just play? I've got some great stories to tell you.
And remember,
if you're having fun, you're already doing it right.
Oh, fuck.
What have you found as the show's kind of developed and where it's at now? Are there any other like core, I don't want to say like core tenets or like guiding lights that you look towards? Like you guys strip down combat and character sheets to something relatively small. Are there any other things that you see as like mainstays of Rude Tales?
Well, obviously there's the humor. Today, right now with you, I'm speaking very seriously about very serious craft issues that we then apply to our pee-pee-poo-poo jokes. So yeah, there needs to be an element of comedy to it. We like to have characters that have some heart. You lure them in with the laughs, and then when you fall in love with the characters, we twist the knife. Love to do that stuff. And then in terms of like how the show is produced, I would say one of our greatest strengths is the trust that we all have in each other as improvisers and as storytellers and actors and comedians. Like I said, I was able to just be like, hey, play new characters today, please. Like, just make them up. Do whatever you want. It's fine. And they fit in great. When I first started making up the Nethermerk stuff, I did a bit of world building that was pretty much just caves, and there's monsters down there, and like there's some nasty things, and then like really no more specific than that. And then I went to the group and I said, here is the basics of my setting, kind of give them a bit of a vibe. You know, I was like things are really awful down here. It's like, if you were to survive, you must be a monster or have some way to defend against them. You know, you might act, you could be from a culture that thrives down there. And then they came to me with their character ideas. Like Carly came to me with, she wanted to play a bat from a bat town. And, you know, Tim wanted to play a human. Joe wanted to play a kobold. And Allie wanted to play a glow pixie who would be rented out as a flashlight to explorers. And from there, that's when I did the real meat of this world building. I was like, okay, let's really make something interesting with the fact that Tim is playing the only human down there. And then that's where I came up with this idea that humans are on the surface and humans are super powerful and mysterious and all this other stuff. And like, it's a big deal that he's one down there to them, even though humans, we know, relatively unspecial. Not to take all of our achievements for granted.
Let's take everything away from the entire human race.
Yeah, right. But. usually in the context of fantasy. You know, humans get to you get to add extra points to your stats, I guess, because you don't get cool dark vision and stuff.
I also love taking the person who chose the quote unquote normal fantasy race and being like, no, you're special, actually.
This is also that's just something that delights me in general. I really, really think it's funny to make humans a really big deal in fantasy settings just because I think it's so absurd. So this really gave me the chance to lean into that. And then from like Carly's bat character, I made up this whole bat society. And, you know, I was like, oh, let's put Joe and Allie just together. Let's not, like, they seem like they're a good match. Like, make them a team. And then I kind of just like, I was like, okay, like I really wanted to do a thing with the spiders because, again, that's huge with the drow and all that. And then I kind of came up with the basics of where this plot is and like kind of the various forces that could antagonize them. Kind of made up stuff that could be a problem no matter which way they walked. They were going to run into trouble no matter which way they went. And then I said, all right, let's see which way they go. And I just... It's so collaborative. I base every next episode off of what they did in the previous one. I have the slimmest like plot point that they might eventually get to. But largely it's very back and forth. And I really love that about the show. And I think it's what makes it like really exciting is like, nobody's going to be accusing me of railroading because I can't be vaulted.
I've been really loving, I think the more we talk to GMs, the more we talk to anybody, I think more and more people take that similar approach of like, I only know what's going to happen about 1 second ahead of when it's going to happen. Like you kind of plan the big bones of stuff and then you just go with your players. And I had a thing recently where I was like, it's weird that this is the only art form that does that. You know what I mean? Like I started having that thought. And then I was watching, I've gotten really into watching documentaries about Hayao Miyazaki and like reading a bunch of his like essays and stuff. Turns out that guy does it too. He does not write scripts. He draws storyboards and figures out the story as it goes. Like he has a whole production team working on a story where none of them know the ending yet because he hasn't written it.
I think that is, I've seen that in animation a few times and I think it's insane.
he's very clear that he doesn't think this is correct or good.
It is,
but
God,
it's what he does.
It's so funny to watch him smoking a cigarette and just being like, what I am doing is very foolish, but that is what I must do.
Exactly.
Animation was a mistake. There's a documentary about the making of The Emperor's New Groove. Have you seen that?
I've read the like oral history article that's okay. Like 15,000 words. I haven't seen the documentary.
Yeah, Disney doesn't want you to watch it, but it's out there.
The story behind that is wild.
Yeah, and it's very much like, yeah, it's like, oh, we had voice actors come in and record an entire movie. Like, there's a version of The Emperor's New Groove that Owen Wilson is in.
Yeah, and all the music is by Sting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the main thrust of the documentary is it's by Sting's wife, and it's meant to be like, oh yeah, Sting, I'd love to do what, you know, what they got Elton John for, you know, for Lion King. That's going to be my Lion King. It's like, and then more and more as this movie develops, it's like, no, it's not, man. No, it's not working out. Sting wrote like 2 albums worth of material that will never see the light of day for that movie. And just got to...
The movie, yeah. Still great,
though. That's incredible. That's the thing. It's like
phenomenal movie.
So wild.
Movie has no right to be that good.
Yeah, yeah. I think the documentary is called Empire of the Sun or something like that.
That sounds about
yeah,
right.
Yeah, I encourage people to go watch it as illegally as possible.
Really stick it to the mouse.
Yeah.
I think all that to say is that I had a brief crisis of conscience, or a crisis of faith about making things like this and making things an art form where you're just kind of going day to day in a way that I was like, that doesn't feel like, is this a serious art form? Is this real? And then when you see the Hayao Miyazaki doing it for, you know, The Wind Rises and The Boy in the Hair, and you're like, okay, actually, you know what? Get off your own back. This is a legitimate way to create art and create things.
Yeah, I think we're so used to, you know, multiple drafts and really plotting things out and all that. And I think it is just an illusion. It doesn't, we're all still just making it up.
It's also like the writer's room model in television. Like, writer's room obviously then take it through the multiple drafts and polish, but like that initial like ephemeral writer's room moment is very much creating an emergent story in the room, and then how do we take that emergent story and fit it into 10 scripts?
Yeah, absolutely. That writer's room thing is, it's like, oh, this thing that like cracked us all up in the room, how do we preserve that in the final product? And that's really where it gets tricky. As someone who has worked on a cartoon where, whew, I don't think any of my jokes made it into the final thing. very hard to do.
But it's also kind of taking that writer's room thing, because ultimately when you go from writer's room to a film script, you're converting one art into another. And like, you've got to fit this writer's room, fun, improv, back and forth jokes into a film, which is just inherently something different. But taking this writer's room improv heavy thing as its own thing is just something that I'm still like really learning to love, I guess.
Yeah, don't tell network executives that they could just pop a mic in a writer's room and probably put it on podcast platforms. Otherwise, they'll stop paying for TV shows.
Yeah, you know, it's, when you mentioned that, something I have discovered about my game mastering style for podcasting anyway is I especially when I'm having Branson do NPCs, I kind of let myself recede from the production a little bit, and I see myself a lot more as directing the actors, because they are all like, you know, they're improvising and they are firing from the hip and it is chaos. And sometimes someone will say something really great and it won't get heard by another one of the characters. And then they'll say a line that cannot be ignored, is driving the plot forward, and this other fun thing could get lost. And often what I will do is I will pause and I'll say, you know, Joe, please hold on to that. That's really good. First, can I get Carly's reaction of this character from this big moment? We need this reaction. And then you pop in and say that, and then we'll keep going. I do a lot of that. And that's been very useful for that kind of making a story happen out of a bunch of comedians yucking it up in a room who are, by the way, also just like so eager to tear down the walls of your world building the second you let them look at it. Just
wait a minute, this is just paper.
Yeah. I feel like you're identifying something that is such a key difference between running a game for fun at home and running a game when you're making an entertainment product. And I think it's something that we've circled around a lot on this podcast. Are there any other things in that vein that you think are really different about the fact that you're making something for entertainment versus if you were running the game at home?
Yeah, totally. Like, I think if I were just running it as a fun game for home, it would be a lot more sandboxy. That's another one. Besides just like the rules, like, yeah, you know, it's let them go chase whatever silly thing they want, you know, in a home game. Like, you can see it in the modules, right? It's like, you know, like Ravenloft is full of a gazillion locations with even more NPCs, so that the players can just kind of wander around and do it however they want. And I think that to create that kind of world for our show would be a great exercise in frustration. I think, you know, I think they wouldn't go talk to all the people you'd made up. Or like, you know, you end up trying to cram it all in, which can feel pretty awkward. You're like, no, go to this cool thing I made. Ah, now you got to go to this cool thing I made. Versus, which is obviously the intention of those kinds of things, it's just like, it just gives them options. But like, if I'm making all that up, I'm going to want them to go see it, you know? So I think better to just come up with the interesting things a little bit at a time. Just take the flashlight approach to seeing how much of the world is ahead of them.
I kind of want to look at real quick the kind of the business side of actual play, because between the two shows on Bucket of Milk, your production company of These, Those, and Rude Tales, you guys have like a very robust Patreon. Like this is you are in a spot that is enviable for a lot of actual plays.
Rude Tales of Magic literally pays my rent. yes, it's very nice.
That is a thing that everyone who runs an actual play would love to be able to say. And I'm curious what you guys, A, if you have any advice for people who want to get to that kind of position, but also like if you have any advice of once you're getting close to that position, hey, here's where we fucked up. You know, here's what are the,
ooh, yeah, sure.
What are the ways to avoid those pitfalls?
So let's see here. There are some aspects of the business that I am a little bit uncomfortable with that seem to be necessary, which is sort of leaning into the parasocial aspect. You know, fans of stuff want to get closer to the creators in some way. And a lot of our, you know, a lot of our Patreon is kind of facilitating that. So, you know, we put out the main show for free. And then a lot of the stuff that we have paywalled are just chat shows. You know, it's just us as ourselves. And it feels like, you know, just kind of hanging out with us, and like the topics don't necessarily matter. Thankfully, we are all such charming and hilarious individuals. Of course, you're going to want to pay for that. And like I said, I'm a little bit uncomfortable opening myself up to that. But I also, you know, I got over it real quick when I realized that's why I listen to all the podcasts I listen to. Yeah. I don't really care what Griffin Newman's opinions are about movies. I think his conversation, I just think he's a very interesting person to listen to on Blank Check, you know? He is very well informed of movies, obviously. Of course, it's interesting to hear him talk about movies. But I do kind of only listen to the episodes that are about movies I'm interested in. But yeah, like, you know, I listen to shows like that for the same reason. So like that is part of it, is just like finding a way to get your listeners who want more the opportunity to pay for more. And the other kind of thing that I felt weird about, but like kind of accepted, is like, it literally is we do rely on real ass patrons of the art, like old school Medici style, like, you know,
yep,
people who do not expect the precise value of their dollar back to them in what they get. They want to support you because they like what you do and they have the extra money lying around to help out. In this capitalist society where you know, like I said, you want value for money. It feels weird, but like it's ancient. It really is. It's like there are people who have money who want to pay for art, and you're the person who makes the art, so you take the money. So that is also part of it. Is, you know, we have, you know, our Patreon tiers are like, I forget what it is. I forget what the lower one is. I think it's $10 a month. But like, that's more than a streaming subscription, right? Like, there is an element there where people are
not anymore.
Oh, well, I don't know. Yeah. Listen, my wife pays for those streaming subscriptions. And then we have even higher. We have insanely high, you know, tiers for people who clearly just want to have a way to support the show. And they do it. We do also sell ads. You know, since we joined HeadGum, one of HeadGum's big advantages is that they have an ad sales team that really handles all of it for you, except for the actual reading of the ads. And that helps, you know, with the income. It's not a giant portion of it. The Patreon pays for a lot more. But yeah, I'd say that's the big thing, is like, allow people a way to support you. Allow them a way just to get to kind of hang out with you, as it were, a little bit more. Or, you know, just like have your internet friends who you've never met chattering in your ear while you do dishes. It's a nice thing. But then also where we really see success and where we unfortunately do not have the bandwidth to do more of it is when we play other games on the behind the paywall. Before I was running Nethermerk, I was doing Merkborg, which is a super cool game that is like very grimy and nasty and super fun. And we've done a lot of like one-shot things behind the paywall, and those ones always drive subscriptions. And we simply do not, we are at that awkward growth period where it's just like, we're not quite making enough money that we can like have somebody quit a job to like really amp up production on those things. But like, it's because we're not doing them, it's stalling a bit, and we're really trying to figure out how to do that.
And then I'm curious with the, because I think both Ellie and I feel pretty similar about the necessary but kind of uncomfortable parasocial relationship aspect. Was that the reason why, for when you guys started up a Patreon for these those Stars of Space, it was largely not bonus like talkbacks or like personal content? It was just an additional episode every month. Like was that a clearer cut thing for you?
No, I don't think so. Actually, I think that was just because that was an experiment we wanted to try. We wanted to see if we could have it just be purely episodic content where you can mix and match the episodes however you like, very similar to, you know, the first season of Star Trek Next Generation, you know, Monster of the Week kind of a thing. And it's like, all right, if you like this so much, there's just another episode of it every month. And we wanted to see if that worked. And obviously, well, it's not obviously, it's obvious to us, I'll tell you. Those Stars of Space has a smaller listenership than Rude Tales does, but it is a hardcore audience. We have the core group that are locked in, that love the show. And that was able to help us make what was another difficult business decision, which was that we had to look at the fact that like those was really draining our resources in terms of time and energy, and was much more difficult to coordinate schedules around because we don't do a camp thing. I was personally growing really sick of trying to do improv on Zoom. It was becoming very difficult. Just little lags will kill you. It'll just kill the thing immediately. And so Joe pitched like, you know, why don't we see if we can take those to just a purely paid for podcast? And we did. And we have lost very few patrons. Those people are in it to win it, and I love them so much. How's that for parasocial? I love them. And I will say, you know, like hanging around in the fan Discord and stuff, I think we have cultivated a very good fan culture there. People are very respectful of each other. They are cool. I popped in the other day to have just a conversation about Spider-Man in like our little sequential art sub Discord. So kudos to them. They make it a little bit less uncomfortable for me to be a famous person.
That's great.
So, Chris, kind of as we're working towards a close here, I always am curious to talk to people who do AP or TTRPG stuff and something else, and you do comics.
I do a lot
as well.
Of other stuff. Yeah.
And I'm curious from your work in comics and writing outside of TTRPGs and AP, like what are the biggest things you've taken into AP?
Ooh, what a question. I have to think about it for a second. What have I brought from comics? I think the biggest thing that I've brought is just being a person who has been making serialized stories for a very long time. When I started in comics, it was writing and drawing my webcomic, The Adventures of Dr. McNinja. And that was, I would put up a page 3 times a week. And I had come from a comic book tradition. I mean, it's weird to say that because I was starting in webcomics. But what I mean by that is that, like, I read monthly comic books and I went to art school for a program in making comics. I have a degree in cartooning. and my instructors were people like Walt Simonson and Klaus Janson and David Mazzucchelli, incredible icons of superhero comics, who all worked with Frank Miller. One on RoboCop versus Terminator and the other two on Batman. So like I learned all this stuff about story in 22-page chunks. And then when I got into webcomics, I suddenly had to shift my attitude towards the story being told in one-page chunks. And learning how to keep an audience invested and interested in these start and stop kind of shorter increments versus the monthly books was definitely something that I bring to this podcasting experience. Like, I know there needs to be a balance of, you know, humor, of laying down just story groundwork, like keeping that plot moving, having, you know, interesting action, and always, always having open questions. a cliffhanger is not enough. Treating it like a literal page turner is very useful to kind of having a successful show, not just in terms of the mercenary keeping a hold of the audience and their buckaroos, but like literally just like making something fun to listen to. That's definitely something I took from comics, is like the lessons in a serialized narrative.
It's a great answer.
Whew, got there.
Chris, before we get out of here, we've got one last question we like to ask everyone who comes on the show, and that is, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our cute way of asking, what is a person, a game, a show, a resource that you'd recommend to our audience? Could be inside of tabletop, could be totally unrelated to tabletop.
Oh, let's see. One sec. I had another answer prepared, and then I just thought of this one. So
that means it's the good one.
Yeah, I am currently reading Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and an informal talks on Zen meditation and practice. And I'm showing you on camera, and now I will describe what I'm showing to the listener. It is a slim volume. But I read a paragraph, and then I have to put down the book and take a walk and think about it. Yes, I...
Is that how the book is designed, or is it just that potent?
I think it's just because I am so new to these practices that they're just constantly... What seems to be taken as assumed by the author of this book, because it seems to be he is writing it towards someone who is an actively practicing, you know, student of Zen, and I am quite new to it. I think that, like, it's just blowing my mind constantly. Yes, I'm finding great peace in the idea of the beginner's mind. So that's nice. Mm. So go out there and practice Zen, everybody. It's good for you.
Hell yeah.
We'll put a link to that book in the show notes.
Thank you so much, Chris Hastings, for coming to the table. Do you want to let the people know where they can find you and when they can listen to Rude Tales of Magic Nethermerk?
Yeah. So you can find me at my Linktree. It's just Linktree Dr. Hastings. I'm also, you know, I'm everywhere as Dr. Hastings. I really got that name locked down a very long time ago, to the consternation of every single other real Dr. Hastings out there that thinks they have my email address. And I tell you, Scott Hastings, you do not. These guys, they sign me up for their everything. They think I've been booked into hotels. I have gotten consultations from carpenters for all these dumb doctors who think that they're the only Dr. Hastings. Anyway, I'm Dr. Hastings everywhere you can find me. You can find Rude Tales of Magic in whatever you listen to a podcast on. Our website is rudetalesofmagic.com. I believe that's it.
And if you want more gamey content from us, you can check out the 20-sided newsletter and the many-sided media Discord. Those are both very fun places to hear what we're doing and chatting about. Those are both going to be linked in our show notes. As always, rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.